everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. So, ghosts have been on my mind lately, partly because I listened to a podcast episode from Philosophy on the Fringes. Great podcast, check it out if you haven't already. And partly just from seeing an argument break out on Twitter about it. And I was surprised to see that skeptics have been making very similar arguments for about 2,000 years. I came across a link to an internet encyclopedia of philosophy entry on a philosopher named Wang Chong. He was an early Chinese philosopher who wrote during the Eastern Han Dynasty, and according to the entry's author, Alexis McLeod, he's often interpreted as offering a materialist and skeptical philosophical system. She says, quote, "Wang offers a number of arguments against what he sees as the common and superstitious belief in ghosts and other paranormal entities." Skeptics were fairly triumphantly presenting his arguments against ghosts, so I gave them a look, and I didn't think they were great, so I thought we could go through the three that I saw, and I could provide some grounds for doubt. So I'll spend the least time on this first one, since it's pretty heavily dependent on the understanding of the physical world that was prevalent in this guy's time and place. So number one, the argument from physical shape. The death of a person is the result of the body losing the animating qi, or vital essence, and once the qi is separated from the body decays. All will admit to this. If this is so, however, and the person's qi is still existent, how can this qi manifest itself in the form of a physical shape? It is not a body, it is qi. But when one sees a ghost, one sees a body. But if the person has died, they no longer have a body, so where could they get another one? They cannot take over another living body, which will already possess its own qi. Thus, the view that people, when they die, become ghosts is nonsensical. So, Wang has an elaborate metaphysical system where he details the nature and behavior of qi, and Wang apparently attributes all motion and causation to qi. You can read about it more in that encyclopedia article if you're interested. And the argument against ghosts here seems to boil down to, that's not how qi works. But qi is not real, so I don't see why I should find that compelling. If anything, the existence of a non-bodily life force would seem to lend support to ghosts, not the opposite. So qi apparently has the power to interact with the physical world, since it animates our bodies. Well, if that's the case, why couldn't it animate something else? Why couldn't it animate some physical particles around it temporarily? Why couldn't it have some kind of causal connection to other parts of the physical world? Why can it only animate an entire human body? Why couldn't it play on the senses or manipulate the brain of the person experiencing the ghost directly, causing a hallucination without manifesting publicly at all? Are there rules to qi that I don't know about that prevent both of those possibilities? It just seems like if you're going to buy into qi, I mean, this is really not coming into contact with what most skeptics think, but if you're a Chinese skeptic from 2,000 years ago, and you believe in qi, I don't really see how you have a leg to stand on when it comes to ghosts. I'll add that if we're interpreting this argument as, how could a soul have shape and size when souls are non-physical? First off, I think that's a stretch because qi is not a synonym for soul. Remember, Wang thinks qi is the underlying principle of causation. Everything that happens, happens because of qi. That's not a description of a soul. If we did interpret his argument that way, it would also put him in the odd position of believing in souls but not ghosts, which I guess is a coherent view, but once you're a substance dualist, the door is pretty clearly open to ghosts. So if we're making a different argument that sounds kind of similar to his, how could a soul have shape and size? Then I think we could respond, as I just did, to Wang's argument. Souls can, as per hypothesis, interact with physical human bodies. So they could possibly also interact with physical particles not constituting a human body. They could influence the particles in this room to form a vague shape. I mean, why not if we're playing in the dualist sandbox? Maybe it would seem arbitrary to say that souls can only influence physical particles if they form the rough shape of a human body or brain. But even if they can only causally influence brains, maybe they could causally influence the brain of the experiencer, the person seeing the ghost, causing them to have visions or hallucinations without manifesting publicly. If they can causally interact with brains, then why not? So on those two options, we wouldn't actually be saying that souls have shape and size. And in case you're one of my listeners who's a Chinese skeptic from 2,000 years ago, we're not saying qi has shape and size, and yet ghosts could appear to have both. So the second argument, and this one is better, I actually used to endorse this argument, the argument from population. If people become ghosts when they die, there should be more ghost sightings than living people, as the number of people who have lived in the past is far greater than the number of people now living. But this is not true. Ghost sightings are rare. Thus, it cannot be that people, when they die, become ghosts. Okay, so like I said, I liked this argument for a while. I used it a couple times. There have been about 100 billion people, I think, who have lived and died. Okay, well then ghosts should outnumber living people by more than 10 to 1. Well, assuming we don't have a major reporting problem, assuming we know exactly how many ghost sightings there are still a few reasons why the number of ghost sightings could be drastically lower than the population of deceased humans. So here are a few possibilities, and of course these are speculative. We're talking about ghosts, but if skeptics are going to make arguments against ghosts, they can't help but make implicit claims about the nature of ghosts. You can't just be above it all perpetually. You can't make an argument against a thing without making some implicit assumptions about the nature of the thing you're arguing against. So skeptics are implicitly making claims about ghosts and how it all works, and I'm wondering what their justification is for believing that if ghosts are real, it would all have to work the way they're assuming it would. So, for example, are skeptics saying we know that if ghosts exist, they must be confined to Earth? There's no otherworldly realm for them to go to, like heaven or hell or purgatory or something else, and there's nowhere else in the physical universe that they can travel to. All ghosts are necessarily confined to Earth. Why would we think that? And if we reject that assumption, how does this argument from population get off the ground in the first place? My point in raising these questions is that the assumptions skeptics are making need to be argued for, and that these objections that they're raising don't just attack the ghost hypothesis narrowly. They're attacking the belief in disembodied minds, plus a handful of auxiliary hypotheses that are not essential to the belief in ghosts. In other words, their arguments could actually work, and ghosts could still be real, because their arguments, even if they're successful, don't come close to proving what they seem to think they prove. Of course, it is speculative to say that ghosts are not confined to Earth, but it's also speculative to say that they are, and the argument from population doesn't make any sense if you don't make that assumption. Skeptics don't get to just wash their hands of any speculation here. So here's another question. Why would ghosts have to be visible to the naked eye at all times? I mean, we can't see all kinds of ordinary physical things. If we're seriously contemplating ghosts, I don't see why I have to assume that they are always visible at all times to human beings. I mean, I can't see neutrinos, but I think they're real. Obviously, I'm not saying the evidence there is equal. I'm just saying it is an assumption, one that I see no reason to accept, that if ghosts are real, they should be visible to the naked human eye 24/7. Why are you, as a skeptic, making that assumption? What is your justification for saying, those who believe in ghosts must accept this? Okay, here's another question. Why would it be a law of nature that each and every person becomes a ghost? Maybe some people are annihilated. Maybe not everyone becomes a ghost. Maybe some people become ghosts and then die somehow. Maybe you don't become a ghost and then live eternally. If ghosts are real, then there's some kind of afterlife for some people. But who knows how long that is? Why would it have to be for an eternity? You have a finite earthly life, you get to live for a few decades, and then maybe in your next ghostly life, you live as a ghost for a short time, and then you move on to the next thing or you're finally annihilated. You finally disintegrate into nothingness. There. Now everyone's happy. Everyone wins. Ghosts are real, there's an afterlife, and also, there's nothing but blackness that awaits us all in the end. That way skeptics and ghost believers can both be right. I'm trying to form practical solutions. I'm trying to be a reasonable centrist here. Now, I know these sound like far-out possibilities, but I will remind you that we are talking about ghosts. I'll say it again, if we're taking this seriously, then how is this not a real question? How do we know that ghosts live forever? Why would we think that once you become a ghost, you just live for infinity years? Why is that the default assumption? I mean, maybe ghosts have a finite life. Maybe they live for 15 minutes, I don't know. or 15 years, or 15,000 years? Maybe there's something after the ghost life, or maybe that's when it finally ends. What is your justification for thinking that ghosts have to live on Earth, they're visible at all times, and they live for infinity years? You have to give me some reason to think that that would be the case, or that ghost believers have to accept this, because otherwise I'm not sure how this objection from the population size works. In order to present this argument from population, you'd have to also assert that each and every person becomes a ghost, no ghosts are annihilated, or move on in some other way, they can't go anywhere else, and they have to be visible to the naked eye at all times. Why believe any of that? Okay, there's another huge problem with this, which is reporting. We don't have a definite number indicating how common ghost sightings actually are. Lots of people see ghosts, but they don't share it because they think it makes them sound crazy. I talked about this a little bit with historian Dale Allison. There's this statistic from early on in your book that can illustrate one of those reasons I wanted to have you on. Mm-hmm. It was the case of the researchers in Sweden in the 1990s who studying, they were studying bereavement, and they interviewed 50 people who had recently lost a spouse, and they said, you know, have you ever encountered your dead loved one? And only one of them said yes of the 50. Anyway, would you mind telling how that ended?
So you're right. One of those who was interviewed said, yes, I'm in touch with my dead husband. And they didn't pay much attention to her because I guess she was into mediums and, you know, that sort of thing. But they thought that that was really low given the anecdotal evidence that they had heard. So they were really shocked. And so they went back to the drawing board and they talked to each other and they said, maybe we simply approached this incorrectly. And so they went back and they talked to these same people. And before asking them what they had experienced or not experienced, they had a little preface which said, you know, people who think they've been in contact with a dead spouse aren't mentally ill. And it's a normal part of mourning to feel the presence of a dead loved one or to hear a voice from the beyond and so on. So they preface their questions with, if you say yes, we don't think you're crazy. And as soon as they did that, it went to half of them. I mean, it went from 1 to 25. Statistically, that is unbelievable, right? And so I love that example because it speaks to the fact that we often are surrounded by a social censorship that we're just not aware of. But since I've written this book and since I've been speaking on its subject for years, I know that this is everywhere. This is not just in religious circles. I mean, it's not just in secular circles. It's also in religious circles. And many times people will come up to me and they'll confide stories. And they are frequently prefaced with, I only told my husband, or I never told anyone, or I only told, you know, one or two people. So things happen and people keep them in. And I think because of this social censorship, we really don't have a sense of how common some experiences are because people just don't report them. There's another incident in the book that I like to bring up. I was in Maine in our farmhouse a number of years ago. My daughter was sleeping in another room, and she came to see me in the morning, and she told me about something that had happened to her that night. And it was some sort of truly bizarre nightmare, which she thought was more than a nightmare. And it really doesn't matter what it was metaphysically, but she was genuinely terrified. And she told me, I think it was just last year, that she had suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome for 10 years from this nightmare, whatever it was. But the thing that I remember is she came and she told me right after it happened, because she knew I was open-minded. And then she said, Daddy, don't tell anyone because they'll think I'm crazy. And I've always thought that's really sad because you are not crazy. You are a perfectly smart, intelligent, well-adjusted person. You're rational. You yourself are trying to figure out what the heck was that. She didn't know what it was. She wasn't like a true believer who knew that these were, you know, demons from hell or something. She had no idea what this was. But it really did happen to her. And since then, she's gone through the literature and discovered that other people have this experience, whatever it is. But my point is that people keep these things to themselves way more often than we realize, which is why we have a false perception of the world.
Yeah, we have a false perception of what the data even are, because we think that like maybe these things happen on the fringes. But in fact, a lot of these things are, you know, really common. So we don't have any definite figure for how common ghost sightings are. And further, in many ghost stories, the experiencer doesn't realize it's a ghost during the occurrence. It's only later that they find out the person they were speaking to had died before their experience. Most ghost stories don't involve a translucent sheet. So I think there are at least two reporting problems here. First of all, I think people are self-censoring. And secondly, it's possible to experience a ghost without knowing it's a ghost. And according to Dale Allison, having an experience with a ghost where you can't tell in the moment that it's a ghost is more consistent with ghost stories historically than the ones with the translucent sheets. Okay, so the third and final argument is the argument from ghostly efficacy. This one is kind of funny. If a living person is harmed, this person will immediately go to a magistrate and bring a case against the party who harmed them. If it were the case that people become ghosts when they die and can interact with living humans, every ghostly murder victim would be seen going to a magistrate, telling him the name of the killer and the means of murder, leading him to the body, and so forth. This is never witnessed, ever. So that last statement is not true. There's one case I know about where this did actually occur in 1897, and I've attached a Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World episode about it. It's called The Greenbrier Ghost. So here's what it reads on a plaque in West Virginia commemorating the events. Interred in a nearby cemetery is Zona Hester Shue. Her death in 1897 was presumed natural until her spirit appeared to her mother to describe how she was killed by her husband Edward. Autopsy on the exhumed body verified the apparition's account. Edward, found guilty of murder, was sentenced to a state prison. According to the WHO, the world homicide rate is about 6.2 per 100,000. So that's 500,000 angry ghosts that we're not seeing going to the magistrates or whatever the equivalent is. I mean, first, a lot of these cases are solved. Secondly, I'm not sure what good it would do for some of these ghosts to appear, even if they could. Let's say you were a cop, and a ghost appears to you and says that they were murdered. I mean, would you feel comfortable telling a lawyer or any of your cop buddies that a ghost appeared to you and provided some testimony against a suspect? Like, you would have to lie about, if you got any information, you would have to lie about where you got it from. Besides, how long and hard would you search with nothing else to go on besides the testimony of a ghost? Now, if they tell you where to find something, if they tell you some information that you can check up on independently, then you can go check up on it. Then what are you going to do? As the person who found it, are you going to say, yeah, a ghost led me here? In most cases, I'm guessing not. So once again, we kind of have a reporting issue. So the question is, in the subset of cases where the victim could provide useful information, why don't they? Well, do we know for sure that that never happens? Well, no, because if it did happen, who would freely admit that? You wouldn't have heard about it anyway, at least in most cases. It's actually pretty annoying, and this is something else Dr. Allison and I talked about, that there's a social stigma that discourages people from being honest about their experiences, and then the lack of reporting is then used as evidence by the same people who enforce the stigma. That dynamic, he says, also took place between Catholics and Protestants, Catholics being a little more inclined to believe in ghost stories and other miraculous reports than Protestants, who were, I guess, kind of the first skeptics. And then in places where Protestantism took hold, you can find authors saying things like, oh, interesting, there aren't really any ghost sightings you hear about anymore. It's like, gee, I wonder why. I mean, you can see what happened in this case in 1897, where the mother was appeared to by the ghost of her daughter. Then her mother urged the case to be reopened, which it was, and she was right. Now, how do you think that that woman was treated? Do you think she was treated kindly and respectfully by everyone involved, or do you think she was made fun of? Well, in case you don't listen to the podcast episode, people were not kind to her about it. And I'm thinking not everyone is as obstinate as this woman. I mean, in the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World episode, they read parts of the court transcript. She comes across as kind of stubborn and headstrong and unyielding. she's got her story and she's sticking to it. Like, she seems kind of stubborn. And I'm thinking not everyone is going to be like her. Most people don't have that kind of personality. And if they do want a case to be reopened, they are never going to say, it's because of a ghost. So once again, we kind of have a reporting issue. But in any event, I think this argument, much like the second, makes many assumptions that just need to be argued for. Like the last argument, you'd have to assert that each and every person, or in this case, victim, becomes a ghost. That no ghosts are annihilated. That they can't go anywhere else in the entire universe. And that they would be visible pretty much all the time. And that there's no issue with reporting or filtering. Not to mention, will every person who dies remain psychologically unchanged after death? Will they be just as interested in revenge as they might be prior to crossing over? Like, when I hear accounts of NDEs, I often hear stories about radical psychological changes after the experience. So in the end, I think this argument falls short for very similar reasons that the second argument falls short. So let's take a step back for a moment. What is the ghost hypothesis minimally? I think it's just something like consciousness continues after death. After the death of our physical bodies, our subjective point of view continues on in some way or another. And I suppose that the living can be made aware of this. There's also a distinction to be made in certain ghost stories. Sometimes it seems like what's happening is more or less a recording of past events. And strictly speaking, the ghosts don't have a point of view. It's not like anything to be them in that moment. They don't have a point of view any more than the pixels on your TV screen have a point of view. So some ghost stories involve hauntings of that nature, but then there are other ghost stories that basically involve a disembodied mind, a conscious being who's still interacting with the world around them. It's still like something to be them. So that's a caveat worth making because not all ghost stories involve a disembodied mind. But even so, if we're just considering the disembodied mind ghost stories, which I assume is what most people have in mind, the essential core of what I'm calling the ghost hypothesis just doesn't involve very much. And these skeptical arguments don't just attack the ghost hypothesis in and of itself, they're attacking the ghost hypothesis plus auxiliary hypotheses that the ghost believer is not obliged to accept. That's my point. It would be like saying, I have a great argument against theism. And I say, great, what is it? And you say, well, the Trinity doesn't make any sense. Here's why. Okay, that's an argument against certain forms of theism. But surely you could be a theist and reject the Trinity, as most theists throughout history have done. Now, it's still interesting to take the argument on its own terms and think, okay, maybe we've narrowed down the possibilities. Maybe these are good arguments against certain forms of the ghost hypothesis. And I'm fine with that. But you need to be clear about what your target is. And for what it's worth, that is not the spirit that these arguments were being presented in when I came across them. I mean, it should almost go without saying, but we're talking about skeptics here, so you can imagine how they're presenting it. They're presenting it as absolutely conclusive, irrefutable. Only a fucking idiot could go on believing in ghosts after these devastating, conclusive arguments that wrap everything up once and for all. I can point you back to the posts that, you know, drew my attention to these arguments and to this encyclopedia article. I'm saying the people posting them did not have an accurate idea of the scope of these arguments. They thought they proved there are no ghosts, period. Consciousness does not continue after death, and there could be no recordings of events, as it were. You know, the two types of ghosts I was alluding to earlier. There are no ghosts of any kind because of these three arguments. We can know this. Which again is like saying the Trinity doesn't make sense, therefore God doesn't exist. So continuing with that analogy, I'm not saying the Trinity does make sense. I'm saying that you have not even come close to proving what you think you've proven by showing that the Trinity doesn't make sense. Ghosts may or may not be real, but I don't think these arguments should really convince anybody. And contrary to first impressions, I think these arguments just don't show much of anything. Alright, we've gotten spooky today. I think we're going to leave it there for now. So, thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.